you hear? We can hear. Talking to my guests in the studio. The introduction to our show today, it's a brief one. Today we're going to talk about drugs, addiction, death, how talking about it makes many of us uncomfortable, and what we all need to do to prevent more people from dying. This is The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak, and I know because of the subject that some of you are already getting ready to change to another station, but stay with me for just one moment, because we have some guests today who may just make a difference in your life and someone else's life. Let me get right to it. Ginger Katz is with us in the studio. Ginger and her husband, Larry, run the Courage to Speak Foundation, based in Norwalk. Their son, Ian, was 20 years old when he died from a drug overdose in 1996. Ginger, welcome.
Thank you so much,
and,
Ron.
And you brought Larry, and you weren't,
going
to bring Larry with you today, but he is next to you. It's good to see both of you. And
thank you.
Just as a little inside baseball thing at the beginning, I was just telling you, okay, you're putting on your headphones. That's the knob to turn it up, and that's why I was saying, can you hear?
I can hear.
Okay, great. Okay. 20 years old, 1996.
Yeah, 1996, and nobody was ready for that. He was the first in my town. Maybe, maybe not, probably not, but nobody was talking about it. The doctors told us to tell people my son Ian died of a drug, an aneurysm or a heart attack.
I'm sorry, I didn't know that part of the story. The doctors were telling you after he died, basically, to lie.
To cover up.
Why?
They thought maybe it was protecting us. But nobody talked about it back then. It was just a hush-hush. Nobody spoke out. And I was uncomfortable when they said that. And it was the night before the funeral. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. And I laid there and I knew I couldn't put one foot in front of each other. I couldn't go to the funeral the next day. I just physically, spiritually, emotionally couldn't go. So I woke my husband up and I said, I can't do this, Larry. I can't. I was hysterical. And he held me and we cried and he fell off to sleep. And I actually had a vision of speaking out. And that was my biggest fear. And so I woke him up again. I said, Larry, I want to speak out. And he immediately said yes. I said, if this is happening to us, it's happening to other families and nobody is talking about it. And I never lied about my son. He was a good kid. He made an unhealthy decision to use drugs, and I was not ashamed of him. So the next day, we decided both of us to go to the funeral, bury our beloved son, Ian, and we started to speak out.
How old was he when he first started to do the wrong things?
He was in the eighth grade. Started with a sip of beer, cigarettes, and pot. And I remember the first time I smelled tobacco on Ian, and he was in the eighth grade. And I said, Ian, you're smoking. And I said, and he said, Mom, I just tried it. But his friends told me that's when he smoked cigarettes, sip of beer, and marijuana. I do not underestimate these drugs. These are the drugs that led my son to the drugs that killed him, which was heroin and a prescription drug called Valium. And it was a deadly combination. And he was in recovery for 3.5 months. And that's such a dangerous time because your body's pure, you haven't been using, and the next hit could be so much more powerful. And that's what happened. Took him right out. He didn't have a second chance.
So he was in the eighth grade, 13, 14 years old.
13, 14.
Now starting his first sips of beer, smoking a few cigarettes, and you said pot?
Uh-huh.
Was this all readily available to him from friends or from stores? Or
Friends. You know, older brothers, sisters, whatever. And that's even, children now even start earlier. The first average age of drugs is about 11.7 in Connecticut, but it's even lower than that now. The vaping, too. The vaping is has such popularity in it. It's just hijacking the kids' brains. All these drugs, these drugs predispose the children to what they're eventually going to be asked to do.
You know that there are some people who are listening to the radio right now saying, look, 11 years old, I don't believe that.
I'm sorry, I did the work. When you lose your child, you start to study. You turn it all. You turn this topic inside and out. It's almost like you get a PhD in addiction. In order to heal, I had to find out what my child was being exposed to and how this came to this point. And then all his friends after Ian died came to visit, and they spilled the beans. They told me everything. Part of my presentation is based on what they told me of Ian's journey through addiction. And the other part I knew. Now I knew, I practically knew everything, but he did have secrets. He did have secrets. And he hid secrets from his friends too. But I got all the information, and I had the records of what he gave up during his recovery, his first use. So I knew, and then we got close 3.5 months before he died. And he told me a lot of things.
When you say what he gave up during his recovery, so I'm assuming he went to recovery once, twice, multiple times?
He went to a lot of counseling during his years in high school. And transitions were hard for him from middle school to high school, from high school to college. He had counselors. He had some anxiety about, you know, transitioning. But anytime he was smoking, you know, we'd get a counselor, he'd go to the counselor, and then he got picked up by the police, too. Then he went to counseling, and then we had some urine tests, and eventually they were clean, and we thought the problem all went away. But that's what happens. People who are addicted or like using drugs will hide and make believe that they don't do anything like that.
I'm just going to skip forward a little bit, and later on in the program, we'll talk more about his story, because I want to get this in before our break. And then right after the break, Drew Scott is going to be joining us. For those who listen to the radio or watch TV in our region, Drew is a longtime broadcaster, and he lost his granddaughter back in 2017 to a drug overdose. And he's going to tell us about their story. But your son ended up, and so Drew will be joining us on the phone just for a few minutes, but your son went to university.
University of Hartford.
And so he had the grades enough to get out of high school and get into a college.
Oh, yeah.
Even while he was using...
Well, I believe he was, in retrospect, and what I know now, he was addicted to pot in the senior year of high school. And that just predisposed him to anything that was going to be given to him or he would want in the near future or be exposed to.
I know we're going to get into that a lot later, because there is a huge debate going on in New York and Connecticut about whether or not marijuana should be legalized and whether or not it is addictive. And obviously you believe that it is addictive.
It wreaked havoc in our family. And I have a support group for families who lost children, and so many parents, moms and dads told me that this is what they suffered with.
Marijuana addiction.
In early years, early stages. And a lot of parents underestimate it because, you know, the misinformation we get. But you're looking at an adolescent brain. It's a drug. And an adolescent brain is still growing, and it just hijacks the brain. And it causes all kinds of things. I mean, just do the studies. Do the studies. I experienced this firsthand. And I know, as I said, I have so many parents that walk through my doors because of my support group. And, you know, I don't want to get political because it became a political subject. It's a health subject. It's not a political subject. Let the health people, you know, prove it. Have the FDA prove what it is or what it isn't. That's all I can say about it.
Ian graduated high school. He went to the University of Hartford.
Mm-hmm. In his junior year, he transferred his credits from to UConn from Hartford, and because he wanted to be close to home and work on his recovery. He came home on my doorstep, high on heroin, and I got him into a program. And, you know, I like to say the majority of kids don't use drugs, but they're being exposed to it, so they're under a lot of stress with kids that are using. And it's difficult, and every child is at risk for depression, and when they use drugs, it compounds it. And so eventually got into recovery, and then he slipped. And he came to us on the deck. We were sitting outside, a late dinner, and he was talking and talking really fast after 3.5 months of taking one day at a time doing a program. And he said to Larry, "Mom's tough. She doesn't let me get away with anything." And I said, "What do you mean by that, get away with something?" He said, "Just because I went to Hartford, you think I did something?" And Hartford was where the drug dealers were and where he could get his heroin at the time. Because at home in Norwalk, he was working on his recovery. And then why did he go to Hartford? And his girlfriend started to yell at him. Said, "Why did you go there? Why didn't you wait for me? I told you to wait." So I realized he relapsed. It's the way he told me he was going to, he relapsed. And I said, "Do you want my help?" And he said, "I want to see the doctor in the morning." And that was the deal. If he was if he relapsed, which is relapse is part of the recovery, we had a long-term program ready through this doctor. And he was telling me that he wanted to see this particular doctor. So
he knew he was in danger.
He knew he was surprised that he relapsed, and he wanted help, and he asked for help. And I listened, and I wanted him to go into the hospital right away. He says, "No, we'll do it in the morning, Mom." And he went downstairs with his girlfriend, and they did a collage for school. And at 1:30 in the morning, I heard a door shut. And he says, "I'm sorry, Mom," from downstairs. And I didn't want to move because I wanted the conversation. I said, "What's going on?" He said, he renewed his vow to see the doctor in the morning. And I got up to give him a hug, and he was halfway down the stairs. And he said, "Mom, I love you. I'll see you in the morning." And at 4 o'clock in the morning, his dog, Sonny, climbed the stairs to my bed from Ian's bed to try to wake me up.
We'll continue with the story after our break. We have to take a short break. Ginger Katz is with us, with her husband, Larry. Courage to Speak Foundation. We'll be right back. This is The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. Today we're talking about addiction and drugs and death. Drew Scott is going to join us in a few moments, but before I bring Drew in, I just want to finish talking with Ginger Katz. She's here with her husband, Larry, but Larry is sitting quietly right next to her. And Ginger was in the middle of the story telling us about Ian's last day or so.
Yeah, and so Ian went downstairs, and at 4 o'clock in the morning, Sonny tried to wake me up. He climbed 4 flights of stairs from Ian's bed to mine, and I thought he just had to go out. And I was so relieved by Ian's vow not to see the doctor in the morning, who would be instrumental in getting him a program. So I went back to sleep, and I got up from my morning run at 6 a.m. to join my friend who was a nurse, and I heard the television on downstairs in his room, and I saw Ian. He had gone downstairs and did it one more time. So Sonny was trying to tell me something, and his message was undelivered. Ian didn't have a second chance. And years later, I thought if Sonny could talk, he would have a lot to say. So I wrote a book from Sonny's perspective, and he tells Ian's story too.
I'm sorry, Larry.
It's number one on Google.
It's number one on Google. It's called Sonny's Sonny's Story. I have the book in my hands right now. It's How to Save a Young Life from Drugs. And the picture on the front is?
It's Ian and Sonny.
This family beagle.
How old was Ian at that point in the photo?
He must have been about 11.
11 years old.
11 years old.
And it was actually just as you said, two or so years after that, that you believe that he first started to abuse beer, marijuana?
2 years after.
Because he was 11 in this picture,
right,
and so you
right,
said before
right,
that he was 13, right?
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
And he looks so young.
Yeah, they're all good kids. They're making unhealthy decisions. They're not bad kids.
Not bad kids?
Not bad kids.
Drew's
but the reason I wanted to do this is because I wanted to educate children. That's my niche. That's what we do at the Courage to Speak Foundation, educate children. Because the deadliest combination is having a naive child and a parent that doesn't think it's going to happen in their family.
And we all live in denial to a certain extent, don't we?
Oh, yes. It's a human characteristic.
It's how we all are. Drew Scott is with us. Drew, if you listen to the radio in this area on Winds, and if you watch TV, Channel 11, News 12 for a long time, everyone Hi. Pretty much knows Drew Scott. Drew, how are you?
Hi, Ron. I'm okay. I've been listening to Ginger, and I commend her and her husband for speaking out, going public, and writing about their experiences, because I think that's one of the ways that we can try to halt this epidemic and reverse some of the damage that's been done over the past couple of years. I really, tears are streaming down my face when I hear this story.
I'm sorry for your loss.
Drew, what happened in your family?
Well, I had beautiful granddaughters. They were 22 years old, and they were both in college. They had spent a lot of time with us as grandparents, and Hallie Ray Ulrich was 22. She had a generous scholarship at Pratt University and was there for the first year and a half. And through a bad boyfriend, she got involved in heroin. When we found out about it, it had been going on for a few months. And we did our best to get her into treatment programs. But we had to learn about treatment programs, and we had to learn how to navigate the system, insurance, and there are just so many pitfalls for parents and so many profit-making places that are profiteering on the addiction cycle that I'm so unhappy with these days. But after a year and a half, it was September the 7th, 2017, she was camping with her boyfriend in East Hampton. And at about 6:30 in the morning, he wrapped her body. She had overdosed. He wrapped her body in a blanket and dumped her on the side of the road and then left and called 911. By the time the EMS people got there, it was too late. They couldn't revive her with Narcan. She was gone. She may have overdosed during the night. Her boyfriend went and withdrew $300 from her ATM account, and then he bought heroin, went home, and he overdosed and died the very next day. So it's just a tragedy, two families broken all the way around. It was a horrible thing. I'd been on television for 47 years and radio, and I decided the best thing that I could do, people know me, they trust me, I think, and I started speaking out. I told people what had happened, and I retired at the end of that month in September and really went to work in the anti-opioid addiction field. It's been a fight, and I've learned a lot. I'm not an expert, but I just want people to remember Hallie Ray and her fight. I mean, she really tried to get sober, but she had so many things working against her. And like Ginger's son, it started with drinking and marijuana, you know, things that people think are just harmless things. But, you know, for an addictive personality or maybe a family, a child has gone through a trauma, it's terrible. It leads to addiction. And that's what happened with Hallie.
Drew, you served, I believe, your time as co-chair of the Southampton Town Opioid Addiction Task Force is done. Is that correct?
Well, we issued our final report in June of last year, and there were about 100 recommendations that we made to the town board. And then the town board asked me if I would stay on. We now call it the Southampton Town Opioid Addiction and Recovery Committee, and we're in our first year of operation, and now we're trying to get together, make it easier for treatment facilities to operate in our town, and also to get the word out to people. Stigma is terrible, as Ginger and her husband found out. There are a lot of families that don't want to talk about this, But I found that the best way to fight this is to go public and speak out. If it happened to me, it can happen to a number of other families. My work on the committee involves trying to get Oasis funds so we can set up a Thrive clubhouse for people who are in long-term recovery, so that they meet other people who have the same former habit and are working hard to overcome that. So we have alcohol-free Super Bowl. We're planning to have alcohol-free World Series, things like that, modeled after the wonderful Thrive program in hot.
We, Drew, I think we may have lost you for just 1 second. If we have, we'll reconnect with you. Ginger, how do you get, obviously, the Courage to Speak Foundation is for everyone. If there's a problem, speak up. But how do you make that jump? Even though it's a tiny jump, it's a quantum leap. How do you get the parents and siblings and loved ones to say, you know what? Everyone is human. Everyone has a problem. It's okay. Let's just talk about it, because it seems everyone seems to know someone who has an addiction in one way or another.
How do you make that leap?
How do you make that leap? How do you get people to take that leap of courage, that leap of faith?
People don't realize it's so easy when you have a problem. All you have to do is ask for help. When I started speaking out, I knew I would be speaking out like Drew. In the limousine going to the graveyard. And I knew it. I knew I didn't ask for the job, it was given to me. And I knew I would speak out too. And since Ian died, we've done over 1,000 presentations all over the country. We're in 42 states. And we took it a step further too. We developed a curriculum for elementary, middle, and high school and parenting courses called Courageous Parenting 101. And we have a new one, and it's called Parenting Through the Opiate Crisis and Beyond. So, yes, my education is key. Parents have to find out everything their children are being exposed to, even if they think they're not going to do drugs. They're going to be exposed to them, and their kids, and their brains aren't completely developed, and they make mistakes. They're all good kids making unhealthy decisions. They're not bad kids. It's nothing to be ashamed of. I was not ashamed of my son. And I easily spoke out. I was yearning to do it because I know if this happened to me, it was going to happen to other families. We were good parents. And it could happen. It doesn't discriminate. It just doesn't discriminate. So I'm on the journey since so many years. I mean, we have curriculum in so many states and 87 towns in Connecticut we present. I have at least 8 presentations this month. And I've been to Washington, D.C. I've been to all the conferences for the DEA, the NEOA, the White House. I mean, I've been at every table around. But I found eventually what I need to do is the real work. And my boots are on the ground in the trenches. And I go out and speak, and I deliver curriculum. And teachers, we have 350 teachers just teaching the curriculum, the drug prevention education curriculum. And I have 145 teachers, facilitators teaching the parenting course with me. And that's what we have to do. Knowledge is power. Because when Ian died of a heroin overdose, I didn't even know you could snort heroin. That was 23 years ago. Snorting heroin? What the heck is snorting heroin? Dealers know that kids won't shoot a needle, so they market it towards kids, and they put it in a form of powder so they can snort it. They made it easy for these college students. 23 years ago, kids didn't even know it either, what they were putting up their nose. It's okay. It's only snorting it. It could be twice. It could be laced. And it is laced with fentanyl. And that's why a lot of people are dying, too, more so than ever. We have an epidemic of 72,000 people dying every year. That's, somebody said it's like a Boeing 707
every
day crashing
with teenagers.
Drew, also in the studio with us, is Larry Katz. Larry has been nice enough to come with his wife Ginger, and he's been sitting here silently the whole time. But obviously, you have something you want to add.
Yeah, I just want to say that we talk about the progression of addiction today. You cannot even try these things. You know, a lot of people say it's rite of passage to try a little marijuana, try a little alcohol. You can't try it because fentanyl is now introduced through in the marijuana. It's introduced in pill form, and kids do not know what it is. And one little grain of salt of fentanyl could kill you. Just one little grain.
One pill can kill.
So that's how potent it is, and that's why we're having an epidemic right now. So, and just from the government's point of view, the DEA is trying to their best to stop the influx of prescription medicine coming in from Mexico and China, which contains some of these ingredients, such as fentanyl. And they have no way of detecting it. The dogs can't smell it. There's no smell. And now the drug dealers are getting involved with vaping, putting in liquid marijuana. I mean, the trends are just going. We go every year to the DEA's conferences, the NEOA conferences, narcotic officers. They have to be trained to find out the newest trends of what's going on in the drugs. If the law enforcement doesn't know, how would the parents know? And how would the kids know? So it's such a widespread problem.
Drew, from what the Katzes are saying, it's an ongoing battle.
Yes, officers and EMS people who respond to overdose situations have to wear gloves because fentanyl is so powerful. They just seized a large shipment of heroin and fentanyl at the border in Texas. And the DEA agent said there was enough fentanyl there that was smuggled in from China through Mexico that it could kill 47 million people.
It's a form of terrorism.
It really is.
Drew, in your part of Long Island, are the officials, do you think, sufficiently aware of the extent of the problem and what some families are going through?
Well, that was part of the reason that we set up the task force 2 years ago, because a lot of towns didn't know where to turn or what to do. They were aware that there were a number of people dying. I mean, we have two counties here on Long Island, New York. It's Nassau and Suffolk. And in just two counties, we lost 600 young people and some older adults from opioid overdoses, mainly fentanyl-laced heroin. Back in the year 2017. So it was a terrible epidemic. Now, this past year, 2018, due to some public awareness of the epidemic, the number's been cut down, according to the county medical examiner's office, to about 400. But it's still 400 too many. And we also saw a turnaround in Southampton when we set up the task force. We went around the schools as Ginger described. We did public awareness programs at the high schools and some of the other public places. We had a public forum discussion. We also had a candlelight vigil for those that we lost. And we lost 19 fatal overdoses in 2017. But in 2018, after we got active, the number was cut down to 6 in the town of Southampton. Still, it's 6 too many, but, you know, we're a small town in Southampton, and that was, we felt that was progress. Public awareness helps. It helps break the stigma, and the things that Ginger and Larry are doing are tremendous, and my speaking out here, I found, to answer your question fully, people approached me in Brookhaven Town, the neighboring town, also Huntington, and also Islip. And so I've helped set up task forces similar to the one in Southampton, in Islip and Huntington. And we're hoping to set one up in Brookhaven Town through the youth services departments. But there is a willingness now to confront this epidemic and not go into denial.
It's. I also, before the program, I looked up the number of deaths from overdoses in Connecticut, and the number in 2018, I believe, is still being worked on, but they believe that it was stabilized to be around the same as it was in 2017. And in 2017, the number was 1,038 deaths from overdose in Connecticut, which comes out to about 3 or so a day.
Yeah, that's reported deaths.
That's reported deaths. And how many do you think are unreported?
Oh, I can't project that.
Automobile accidents and things like that. You really don't know, you know, what caused the accident. You know.
Or if, as you said at the beginning of the program, what your doctor said to you so many years ago,
silence.
Just say it was an aneurysm.
Yes.
Silence. So that way the family doesn't have to confront this.
That's one of the reasons why I name my organization The Courage to Speak.
We have to take one last short break, a quick minute and a half. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Full Story on WSHU and WSHU.org. This is The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. With us on the phone is Drew Scott, noted broadcaster for many, many years in the tri-state area, and if you were listening earlier, he lost his granddaughter a few years ago, to an overdose. And in the studio with us is Ginger Katz and her husband, Larry. They run the Courage to Speak Foundation based out of Norwalk. Their son, Ian, was 20 years old when he died from an overdose in 1996. Why did you name your organization the Courage to Speak Foundation?
After Ian died, I started to speak out in many high schools, middle schools, and I had the courage to speak about my son's death, and I also got a lot of feedback from the kids on index cards. I wanted to be critiqued that I was going down the right path, and they comment on that, but what they were doing was every index card had the kids' pain on it. They would share their grief and what they were going through, and they were keeping it silent. And I also, Ian had a secret, and he died with that secret. At least we didn't know that secret. Two of his friends did. And a lot of kids keep their pain inside from trauma, or if they didn't make the team, or their girlfriend breaks up with them, or they don't, something goes wrong in their life, and it could be trauma. So I ask kids to find 3 to 5 adults in their lives that they could share their secrets with, because what's happening to kids nowadays, they're coping with drugs. Nowadays and all the time, they're just drowning out their feelings, and they think it's going to get better. And that's on an adolescent. That and life is filled with ups and downs, mountains and valleys, and better coping skills and talking about their pain. So when I started to present, I asked the kids to just share your feelings, and they gave me index cards, and you wouldn't believe the pain these children had. And the social worker said, there's a line never before wrapped around the hallway in the high school in Westport. The kids just wanted to talk after they heard you speak, because you've given them the permission to. They didn't know how to do it. And there's alternate ways to, you know, instead of using drugs. So that's one of the reasons, and Ian's secret, and also just speaking out, have the courage to speak about the topic itself. It was the best-kept secret 23 years ago, and I was asked to lie about it.
Drew, I know you're listening, and like me, with kids, and you're sitting there and saying, hey, everything that Ginger is saying obviously is true, and it's so difficult, isn't it, getting those teenagers to express themselves. Maybe they can do it to each other at times, but boy, trying to get them to be honest with adults is a tough thing.
We ask kids.
Very much so. Peer-to-peer discussions are very good, and that a lot of that goes on in the Thrive Centers that are being set up now with Oasis money. That's money from the state to assist in people who are alcohol or drug dependent. Peer-to-peer is very important. NA has done a good job, Narcotics Anonymous, and a lot of those who have been in long-term recovery have gone into AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and found comfort there. But they've got to seek help and get it from somewhere, a friend, a relative, a stranger, but go get help and talk about it. And, you know, the one thing that we want to see in New York State, and I'm sure Ginger would like to see that done in Connecticut, is when a kid says, I want help, they should get it that day, not a week from now, or make an appointment for next Wednesday. It should happen immediately.
Right. Because once that moment is passed, it may not happen again, right?
Absolutely right.
What's actually happening, there's some legislation right now about when they get revived from Narcan and they're in the emergency room, many times they get released from the emergency room and go home and do it again and overdose and die. They're now trying to say that they really shouldn't release somebody who's actually in withdrawal from a narcotic from the hospital. And also, there's been movement from treatment centers to have people available if they want to go right into some kind of treatment.
I know there is a bill in front of the Connecticut legislature that would deal with just that. So if it would be that if someone has an overdose and is revived, that person would then have to be taken to an emergency room.
Mm-hmm. And they call it a warm handoff.
Yeah, a warm handoff. Mm-hmm. And it makes you, it boggles the mind to think that people just aren't doing that nowadays. But I guess that if you do that, a lawsuit may develop. You never know. Well, so officers have to be careful.
I just want to mention, we asked the kids, why do you use drugs? We asked to get a feedback from kids. And they say peer pressure, I'm bored, I just want to try something out. And what we really find behind a lot of this is pain, that they're in pain. And as my wife mentioned, whether it's not making the team, it's interesting. The one group that they could join in high school where they don't have to practice or train is to join a group that's smoking marijuana. The other groups, they have to train, to be a cheerleader or be on the basketball team, a softball team, whatever. And they do form groups. So it's very difficult for a child who doesn't have any friends and going into a school situation. And that's why the transition is very important and going from school to school.
I'm going to bring up a topic that may irritate some people, but we've done a few programs on it. The legalization of marijuana, both in New York and Connecticut, as they would call it, recreational, not for medical, but so someone would be able to smoke it when they want to in the state without fear of being arrested or going to jail. When we did some of our first programs back in November, those who are on this program, both for and against it, were pretty honest, and they said, we think that this will pass in New York and Connecticut these sessions. And the feeling that I'm getting over the last month or so, as far as Connecticut, maybe not so much New York, is that a movement has been growing against it. And people are saying, slow down, take your time, let's study this a little bit more and figure it out. So with everything, the backdrop that I've given you, I would like to ask Drew, and I'd like to start with you, your thoughts on the legalization of marijuana.
I have no opposition to medical marijuana, but recreational, it's a huge problem. Just study some of the statistics that are now coming out of Colorado State, where it's been recently legalized. The police officers there are just absolutely livid with what's going on. There have been more than double the number of car accidents. There are incidents involving marijuana problems that have been created. It's just enormous. There's no count yet on how many young people have been led from marijuana as a gateway into other drugs. So I've been going around and going to a lot of these hearings where they want to have people say what they want in New York State, and so many people are saying yes, let's do it, but a number of us are saying no, let's study it first and to make sure that this is what we want to do, and if the folks who are very liberal and want to go ahead and do it, we'd like to see some of the tax revenue from that legalization given to long-term treatment facilities in New York State.
Ginger?
The government report, it's called a HIDA report, and they claim, and they've studied this, and drug treatment in Colorado is, for youth, is up 200%. Crime has increased. There's environmental issues. It's wreaking havoc on, and every one of the states that are provided legalization to the people in their state, drug use is at the highest of all the states in the country. So I'd be happy to send anybody a video done by Ohio, Drug-Free
Idaho.
Ohio.
Idaho.
Idaho, called Chronic State, or you can Google it. Take a look at what it's doing to the environment and to children and to our society. And the genie is now out of the bottle. If we decide in Connecticut to do it, and I don't think we're jumping into it because they're beginning to see the studies from Colorado and other states, and they're going to be wise decisions, and there's going to be education in place if possible, but I still don't go along with it because why should we dumb down American youth? They're the future of our society.
I'd just like to say historically, the United States in the 1890s, all drugs were legal. You could get marijuana, you could get cocaine, you could get heroin, everything else. 1915, the FDA was formed, and they made these drugs illegal because they had so many addicts in this country, they thought they would lose the whole country to addiction. And so if we look at the history of that, which they got their foot in the door with medical marijuana, which I do not agree with because medicine goes through a process through the FDA that has to be, you know, and
But
so, it's just regulated.
You do know that the governor of Connecticut, Ned Lamont, has come out in favor of legal marijuana. What would you tell him if he were here?
I think they're looking for popular young votes when politicians say this. I think it's the wrong direction to go in. People make a lot of comparisons to the legalization of alcohol after Prohibition.
Yes.
It's a totally different situation.
Yeah, and Big Tobacco lied, too, that it wasn't dangerous for the human body.
And
now we sued the tobacco industry, and we have billions of dollars from the tobacco industry. Now we're suing or trying, the country is trying to sue the pharmaceutical industry. Give it 5 years and we're going to be suing the marijuana industry.
We have 6 minutes left in the program. With the remaining 6 minutes, if you had your wishes about what could be done nowadays to prevent any more overdoses, what the government should be doing, what parents should be doing, please let us know now. Ginger, go ahead.
Okay. As I traveled around the country and started to speak in all the schools, I would ask the principals, I took an assessment, do you have drug prevention education? And they pointed to me. And I said, no, curriculum. What do the teachers teach? Well, they take things off the internet. So I brainstormed this, and I got experts in prevention to develop curriculum with a team of schools. And I spearheaded that. And as I said, I have a curriculum in elementary, middle, and high school. And I think education is key. And I want Larry reminded me to say this. We do have an epidemic, and treatment is imperative. Recovery is phenomenal, and there's a lot of money going into treatment. And Narcan, we have to save lives, and we have an epidemic. But if we don't look at the other side of the spectrum into the prevention of this problem, we're going to repeat the cycle and we will have a pandemic. We keep on repeating the same cycle. We don't put any funding into prevention. And now we are, because there's an opiate epidemic, and now it's becoming more balanced. But you have to get to children early. We do education of not talking to strangers at a very early age. So if a child is 7, 8, 9 years old and they're asked to come in a car or whatever, their heart starts to beat, they run home to mom and dad and tell someone, and they run away. When a child is asked at 10, 11, or 12 to smoke this with me or try this pill, they think it's fun. And that's because the work hasn't been done. We have to do everything. We have to do prevention, intervention, treatment, and recovery.
Drew Scott?
I think I'd like to see more treatment beds in our area, and long-term treatment funded by insurance. Right now, the best you can do is sometimes 2 weeks, if you're lucky, maybe 28 days from insurance companies, if you have insurance. It's an illness. Addiction is an illness that is a lifetime in overcoming. And, you know, for a person who has cancer or heart disease or diabetes, you can't cure that in 28 days. it's got to be a lifetime of work. And we're just not seeing that now. So I'd like to see more treatment available for long-term recovery. That's one thing. I'd also like to see a lot more public awareness of the terrible epidemic and the problem that we have, because public awareness does make a difference. It doesn't tell the whole story, but there's a lot of commercials and radio spots that we're producing now using kids from either junior high school or high school, and we're circulating this now, and maybe the young people will see people their own age warning against addiction and opioid abuse, and so we're hoping this will help maybe stem the epidemic somewhat. So public awareness and more beds for treatment.
Larry, I'd like to bring you in also, because could you talk specifically to parents nowadays? What should a parent be looking for?
You know, just reading my mind, the number one deterrent of drug prevention is a parent talking to the child about the dangers of drugs. And the statistics we've been taking since 1972 has not changed. Only one in three parents talks to their children about the dangers of drugs. So we have two-thirds of the kids coming to school without that little thing in their brain saying, I shouldn't be doing, taking something, putting it in my mouth, and so forth. But if we could get parents, and we have a very good technique of getting parents out. We have a family night that we are coming up on April 9th at one of the local schools where the kids read their prevention piece, why they won't use drugs, their artwork, their writing, and we invite the parents to come in. And I'm just going to share with this, the way we get the parents in, we have the kids write home a letter to their parents telling them about the program, and how would a parent not respond to a kid?
Okay. All right. We are offering a training. Five trainings are coming up. We have a course called Courageous Parenting 101, Parenting Through the Opiate Crisis and Beyond, and it's at St. Joe's March 12th in Connecticut, Old Saybrook March 27th, Hartford March 29th, and one other place.
But if they go to the Courage to Speak Foundation website, I'm sure everything is listed
there,
right?
Yes.
Everything is there.
Yes.
And Drew, do you have like a website or anything like that where if someone wants more information about the task force or what is taking place on the island?
Yeah, we certainly do. GetHelpSouthampton.gov.
That's a great one. GetHelpSouthampton.gov.
Ginger? I remember it. It's in Greenwich at the YWCA, March 18th.
Right over there on the post road.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And we have 17 more to deliver in Connecticut and beyond.
Drew Scott, I'm sorry for your loss, but I thank you for being courageous and kind enough to come and share with us today. Thank you, Drew, very much.
Thank you, Ron. Appreciate it.
We appreciate your time. And Larry and Ginger, and it's great what you do.
Thank you so much.
And you've taken a tragedy that's unspeakable and unthinkable, and you're trying to help others, and you have our gratitude. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. Of course, you can always drop us an email. Tell us what you thought about today's show. And that is it for today's show. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Ann Lopez is the producer. Special thanks to Terry Sheridan today, our news director. And I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to all of you for being part of The Full Story.